Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. As far as Premier League football is concerned, the countdown has begun. It's T-16. Three more days to wait for Championship football. That's scheduled to begin on June the 20th, though the clubs are up in arms about a lack of consultation. We'll look at that later. But first, Liverpool, a year to the day after they won the Champions League in Madrid. They're going to follow up by winning the Premier League. Now, there's been a lot of talk about neutral venues aid. Does it actually matter where or how they win the title?
It doesn't matter really, does it? Because the gloss, in many respects, has been taken off. They won't be able to enjoy and savour the moment with their supporters. There'll be no packed Anfield. There'll be no you'll never walk alone. There'll be no trophy lift, no parades through the streets of Liverpool. So it's going to be a bit flat anyway. So no, it doesn't really matter. But I must confess, I am baffled, and it's a real head-scratcher for me that some of their games are being considered as neutral venues. They're saying that they can't play at Anfield, obviously for fear of fans turning up. And I feel really sad about that, because it's in essence suggesting that Liverpool fans aren't trustworthy compared to the rest of the supporters in the division. I get the fact that they're about to win the league and that might spark some kind of rush to Anfield. But look, if they were to win it in an away game, if they were to win it in a home game, played, let's say, at Villa Park, a neutral ground, what's to stop fans then flocking to Anfield anyway, if that's instinctively what they feel that they want to do? Personally, I don't get why they would do that, but in this scenario, but that is more than plausible. So, yeah, it's a strange one for me. I also feel that Liverpool fans will surely not congregate around Anfield during a game. Surely, if you're a Liverpool fan, you'll want to watch it on a decent telly, won't you? You'll want to listen to the games on the radio if you can't get access to the telly. Listen where you can actually hear it on the radio, not where you're in a group of people outside your stadium. It's a head-scratcher for me. And personally, I still hold out hope that the police will just trust the supporters, trust Liverpool Football Club to campaign and instruct their supporters not to come to the ground.
Yeah, because as you know, Jurgen Klopp says, he doesn't really care where they win it. But I suppose the fundamental issue, and it's got broader implications, Seb, that lack of trust in fans, there is this lingering mistrust of football supporters simply because they support a football club. You know, is it a social issue we're trying to deal with here as well as a sporting issue?
No, without question, Mike. Football fans have always been treated like a disease. That's proven in history. The costs of doing that are proven by history. I think it's a kind of a truism that applies across sport and across society. If you treat someone badly, they will generally respond without any sort of benevolence. It's very dispiriting, Mike, because no one ever seems to learn from this. No one ever. I mean, if you spend time in Europe, for instance, and I mean, I know I've mentioned this on the pod before, but I went to Spurs' Champions League game in Leipzig, and I saw the kind of the way that the local authorities treated that occasion and the way the home and away fans were policed. It was kind of very much it was almost like a subliminal presence, background presence. It wasn't that kind of overbearing mounted police type situation that you seem to find up and down the country every weekend. And you felt like people were there to help you rather than there to, in capital letters, police you And the expectation always seems to be that football fans, before any event, the planning seems to be bent around a situation where football fans are definitively going to misbehave, and in large numbers, always. There's always the assumption. And if you look around society, if you look around the different parts of our country, in what other situation does that apply? It's like another prejudice. I mean, one of the issues that I'd have with neutral venues plan is it only seems to apply to clubs from certain parts of the country, which I find very difficult to tolerate. Maybe I've got that wrong, but then that's a decision which needs a little bit more context. We need to understand why that is. Why it is that you need to incorporate these measures for supporters from Manchester, from Liverpool, from the Northeast. Logically, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense. So I'd want to understand that a little bit more.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, football doesn't exist in a bubble, and it does. You know, this sort of debate does lead into other areas where actually it was highlighted in the Bundesliga over the weekend, where football looks so out of touch in the way that it penalises players for, you know, showing, you know, basically trying to curtail their freedom of expression. You know, Jadon Sancho was booked for pulling off his shirt and revealing a Justice for George Floyd t-shirt. His teammate Hakimi did the same thing and wasn't booked, so it's inconsistently applied. You've got Marcus Thuram invoking Colin Kaepernick and taking a knee after scoring against Union Berlin. Is it a healthy thing, Adrian, that players express themselves not just as footballers but as human beings?
I think so. Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that the vast majority of people would think more of those players for the support, for actually thinking in the heat of the moment, for thinking of the bigger picture and what's going on in the world. And I support those players. It is a travesty, really, that players will be punished for that. I've never really understood the whole shirt off, yellow card business anyway. I kind of get that players... political gestures are controversial, and they will please some people and really anger others. And there's a danger there, and I don't necessarily feel it should be encouraged. But for me, those players enhance their reputations by doing what they do.
One of the interesting things, guys, sorry, I just want to jump in, like, is that some people seem to want it to have it both ways. They want to be able to criticize, players for living in a inverted commas bubble. And living these sheltered lives. On the other hand, when they do speak out, they get criticised for that too. I always think back to a long, long time ago now, I think it's about 25 years, but I remember Robbie Fowler's t-shirt in support of the Liverpool Dockers when they lost their jobs. I want players to do that kind of thing because I want players to be aware of what's happening in their community. How can someone like Jadon Sancho or Marcus Thuram not be aware of what's happening in America at the moment? How can you ask them not to be? It's an extraordinary argument. With regards to the laws and sort of the booking players for taking off shirts, I kind of understand that, because what can referees really do? I think the game has to adapt around that kind of situation. I think it has to develop a slightly more complex law which deals with exceptional circumstances, which this very much is.
Aren't they getting rid of this law anyway?
I don't know.
In terms of taking off your shirt, I've never really understood what the
isn't
problem
is. Isn't it to protect sponsors? So that if you take off the shirt as a goal scorer, then you're kind of denying a visibility to a sponsor when at the most sort of camera-worthy moment. That might be another myth. I don't know. But
I think it was brought in, wasn't it, about 2014, and it was specifically looking at the political and the religious slogans which were becoming popular, I suppose, and also that we had the personal ones, didn't we? Well, actually, someone takes their shirt off and it's commemorating a friend or a family member, I think that's a very heartwarming thing to do. While we're on Sancho, hat-trick at the weekend, this lad's going to go for a lot of money, even despite the financial circumstances, in a matter of months, isn't he?
Well, he's a very special player, isn't he? Yeah, there won't be... I suppose all of the big guns will be interested in him. It is a question of finance, isn't it? And structuring a deal, and who needs the money most, or who needs the player the most. It's hard to call where he would go, but he would improve any... I think Jadon Sancho would improve any of the top six sides in the Premier League. And And that would include Liverpool because he would compete with the likes of Salah and Mane and just apply that bit of pressure, and it would give Firmino a bit of a nudge as well in terms of the fact that you can play Mane or Salah down the middle as well. So yeah, I think he would improve all of the top six sides. Who's prepared to spend that much money at the moment? I suspect that Borussia Dortmund will cash in on him, and that Jadon himself may decide to go. Personally, I'd like to see him have one more year in Germany because I can only see him getting better and better at Dortmund. The problem is, I think if you are an interested party, like a Manchester United, funnily enough, now is probably the time to get him because transfer fees in general will surely be lower now than they would be in a year's time. And in a year's time, after a season of progress, his price could easily double. So look, if you do want to speculate on Jadon Sancho, now is the time to do it. You just have to take a big hit at a bad time.
Yeah, I suppose if we're thinking about what-if scenarios, I've always wondered what would have happened had Robert Lewandowski come to the Premier League.
He'd have won the Golden Boot, Mike.
He would have done, wouldn't he? But, you know, it's 43 goals this season. He's equaled his best season. He's emblematic in many ways, isn't he, Seb, of a Bayern team, which looked to me at the moment to be the best side in Europe.
Oh, goodness me, Mike. Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. So I was watching their game over the weekend. I was watching the way they're playing. It's full of all these kind of intricate moments and these subtleties. These aren't really qualities that I associate with Bayern Munich. I might be wrong in that, but it's kind of, even when they were coached by Pep Guardiola, who, you know, coaches very attractive football, but it's quite rigid. It's quite structured in its way. And now it's kind of a bit more freeform, and you see the influence of obviously someone like Lewandowski, but the kind of the breadth of influence of someone like Serge Gnabry, for instance, and the kind of the different positions that he crops up in. And then you've got players coming off the bench like Mikel Cuisance, who just sort of fit in and they kind of ad-lib their way through the games. I mean, they are awfully impressive. And I think it's interesting because it's kind of, obviously, about a week ago, they had that game against Borussia Dortmund, and Dortmund seemed to be coming to the end of their cycle. They're going to have to probably lose Sancho. Haaland's not going to be there forever. So they're going to have to go into renewal. And the logic was that Bayern, a year ago, when Robin and Ribery left and Müller was coming towards the end and Hummels was sent back, it was sold back to Borussia Dortmund. The logic was that that was going to happen too. And now you don't see the break. You don't see the end of one cycle and the beginning of another. You just see this continuation of a really intimidating standard. They're losing Boateng at the end of the season as well. He's been a linchpin of that defence for a really long time. You see now Alphonso Davies drop in at fullback. He's just, I know we've been aware of him for a long time, but I don't think people assumed that he was going to develop into this calibre of player. And so it's remarkable. And I can't see a team in Europe that could live with that at the moment. Not even, I mean, especially with Liverpool out of the Champions League. They look awfully strong, but they're also great fun to watch, which I don't think I've ever said that about Bayern Munich before. I feel a little bit dirty saying it, maybe. But, I mean, genuinely, they're thrilling.
You're a hard man to please.
Absolutely.
You're a hard man to please, Seb.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, in that context of the Champions League, where would you fit Manchester City aid in the runners and riders? Do you think they'll use the setback of losing, you know, the Premier League to Liverpool to almost galvanise the rest of their season?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I see them as outsiders still. I look at Bayern Munich and think they're ahead of Manchester City because of the all-round balance of the team. I talked before about the City weakness. It's clearly in the structure of their off-the-ball work. And I think against the elite in European football, that's where they've come unstuck before. And where I think they will probably come unstuck again. So, yeah, I'd put Bayern Munich ahead of them. I think they might struggle against Atletico. Barca and Juve, they'd be cracking games. You know, it could go either way. They could reach the semis. They could reach the final. But I personally still think that there are a couple of sides ahead of them. In terms of what's happening with the possible ban being upheld, or the ban being upheld, it could work two ways. I think that it could be the case that the likes of De Bruyne and Aguero, or the star men, the star men in their pomp, the peaks of their careers, it will hit them. It will be a jolt to them. And they might be thinking, crikey, do I really want to sit out the Champions League for a couple of years at my peak? That could create a really unsettling effect inside the dressing room at the Etihad. The other thing it could do is galvanise them this year and make them even more determined. While we are here, while we are in it, we've got to win it. We've got to take this chance. It could fire them up even more to go on and make history. So yeah, it's a huge, huge time for the club. And, you know, personally, I believe the ban should be upheld and they're just going to have to take their medicine, Manchester City. But it'd be fascinating to see the reaction of their star men, particularly Kevin De Bruyne, because this is a guy that should be playing in the Champions League.
Mm. Do you think they still can potentially win a treble this season when it's eventually completed? You know, having won the League Cup as per usual, got a quarterfinal tie against Newcastle in the FA Cup, and you know we've been talking through the implications of the Champions League. Knowing Guardiola, that will be what he's saying to them behind closed doors, wouldn't it? Look, forget everything else. Let's show them that we can go out and win three trophies in a season.
I guess so. I just not sure whether that's an achievable aim. I suspect they probably will win the FA Cup. But, I mean, given what we've just said about Bayern Munich and the complexity of their forward line, do we think that Manchester City's defence is good enough to cope with that kind of side? I don't think so. I think City will be bounced out by the first good team they play. That's not to say that Guardiola hasn't built something brilliant over the last few years. It's just that at the moment, it's only the front sort of 60% of that team, which is really European class. I think in a way, one of the sort of subplots for this summer is obviously prior to the pandemic and its potential financial effects, we were expecting a big defensive rebuild at City, Mike. Now that still needs to happen, but what's the market like? They're probably going to get some revenue over the weekend. It did seem as if Leroy Sané's move to Bayern Munich is done, so they're going to get a big fee there. Beckenbauer seemed to be... Uli Hoeneß sort of seemingly talking a little bit out of turn about what may or may not already have been done, which angered a few City fans. But, you know, they're not... That is the weak link. They've got problems at fullback because Benjamin Mendy can't stay fit. Centre-back, it just... No matter what they try, if Aymeric Laporte isn't fit, there's a problem. And that shouldn't be the case given how much has been spent on that defence in the past. That's their weak link. That's why they haven't won the Champions League up until now. And I can't see them coping with a Bayern Munich. But also, if you think of some of the other teams left in that competition, I still, you know, can they cope with the very best on the continent? I don't think so at the moment.
Let's look at the clubs who perhaps have got most to gain from the restart. And I'm thinking obviously in terms of qualification for next year's Champions League. Can you see a Manchester United making a late run here? Because, you know, their fixture list is pretty good, isn't it? They've got four of the bottom six to play. And there is a sense, I don't know what you feel, almost like a gathering momentum there.
Yeah.
You know, because of those links with, they've been linked with Sancho, then they're now being linked with Kai Havertz. So there's this, you know, the Empire Strikes Back theme going on in the background, isn't there?
Yeah, and no one's moaning about Ollie, and they can just crack on and unleash themselves. You know, this exciting young team. That they are a team in development. They're not perfect. They're in many respects not ready for high-end Champions League football. Not in the way that the great United sides were, but they've got a chance. And I certainly don't fancy Chelsea to sprint clear of the chasing pack. I think it's going to be really, really tight. And United have got a great chance. You've got Rashford coming back, of course. Huge. Yet to play alongside Bruno Fernandes, by the way. Marcus Rashford. So what an exciting axis that is. And then I've seen pictures and discussions on Paul Pogba and Paul Pogba lining up alongside Fernandes as well. Now, if Pogba and Rashford come back into that team that were doing pretty well, you have to say, before the break, then yeah, that is exciting. They've got a lot to gain, United. They certainly fancy their chances. I think the break has been a win for Spurs. They've got Kane and Son Heung-min back. So they've suddenly got that lift. I think a lot of teams have got stuff to gain. It's Chelsea really at the top end of the table that may be the ones looking over their shoulders from June the 17th onwards. I think Leicester are probably too far clear. Wolves, for me, have the best fixture list. And they are, well, we know that they're incredibly hard to beat. And it would not be a shock to me if Wolves finish fourth.
Yeah, they're certainly my dark horses as well. And I suspect you're the same, Seb. I know you've been really impressed with them. Do you think Adama Traore, he's again been linked to Liverpool. Will that sort of speculation divert him, do you think? Or, you know, is the management structure or is Nuno's force of personality so great that he'll be kept, you know, on the leash, as it were?
I like to think it'd be the latter, Mike. The more I read about this sort of transformation in Adama Traore, the more it seems that he's responded to a particular type of person, particular type of coach. Whether, I mean, as unlikely as it sounds, originally that was Tony Pulis. Pulis was really the first person to treat him with the care and consideration that he needed. And Nuno and his coaching staff have obviously taken that a step further. So, you know, all the reports we read about him, he's apparently a very humble man, a very well-liked person. There don't seem to be many stories of sort of great ego or a player that's liable to get ahead of himself. It's also mentioned just, you know, how intelligent he is contextually in relation to some of his teammates. And I think that kind of player generally recognises what's good for them in the sense of what kind of situation benefits them the most. And having, I wouldn't say made a name for himself, because Adama Traore has been a name for a really long time for a variety of reasons, but having sort of accelerated, you know, operative word, to this new peak in his career, why would you leave that behind? I mean, I covered Tottenham's game at Molineux when they somehow won, but Adama Traore is probably, I know it's a little bit of a neologism and you know, a horrible little modern word that we use too much, but he was genuinely unplayable. And I've never seen anyone do that to Jan Vertonghen. But just the sort of the way he's...
Well, more and more people are doing it to Jan Vertonghen.
Well, maybe now, but then it was news. Like it was kind of... it was one of the most forceful bits of wing play. And I don't think I've seen a winger play like that for, you know, probably about 10 or 15 years. But he just looks so suited to playing in that system, but also with players like Raul Jimenez, Diogo Jota, and Ruben Neves and Gian Martino sort of providing him balls from the centre. I think he's in the perfect scenario. And why would you trade that away for kind of a lunge at, you know, for instance, Liverpool, where he's not going to start. He's not a sort of, he doesn't have the range of abilities that someone like Salah or Mane has. There's absolutely no need for him to be going anywhere. And I hope he'd recognise that.
Yeah, ambition though. And look, as brilliant as we think Wolves are, that they're not one of the big six clubs in the country, not yet anyway. So yeah, look, I think his head could be turned. I certainly think that if one of the big guns came in, I'm not saying he would itch for a move, but that's not beyond the realms of possibility. By the way, Trey, I did a series of pieces on partnerships for the Premier League recently, and basically I classified Adama Traore and Raul Jimenez as the best partnership in the division. No two players have set up more goals for each other than those two. It's quite remarkable. And it's not just one way. It's not all about Traore dashing down the wing and cutting it back for Raul Jimenez. Well, that's happened a lot. It's also about Raul Jimenez sometimes dropping in on a counter, turning and playing that killer pass for Traore to run onto. He did it twice at the Etihad, and it's happened on numerous occasions. These two guys together are gold.
You see the way he responds to someone like Jimenez as well. Like those three as a unit, I don't think they get nearly enough recognition for what they are. Brilliant players and a brilliant unit.
Yeah, I you know, if you look at their fixture, as you know, you mentioned earlier on, I sort of ringed one fixture, which is the game against Chelsea, as a potentially decisive element of the what we have to call the run-in now, I suppose. With Chelsea, this is going to be the acid test of Frank Lampard's management style. You know, he's brought the feel-good factor back. He's encouraged youth. But this is now where they've got to get down and dirty, isn't it, Seb?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's where if there is one weakness, there's one sort of flaw in Chelsea's season. It's been the ability just to tick off those games at home. Think of the games that they've lost and dropped points in. And now that's the only currency. And also, you know, the longer these games, I mean, the more more games they try and cram into this period, we've spoken about this before, of course, but the greater the physical burden on the players, and that's almost certainly going to be to the detriment of style and tactical cohesion. And so the currency is very much just getting it done. One of the things I'm really interested in, Mike, is when they come back, obviously, we've got sort of the slightly nebulous issue with N'Golo Kante, which is quite sure what his status is at the moment, but Lampard's going to have a choice between, obviously, we remember just before the lockdown, Billy Gilmore playing really, really well. Is he going to accommodate Jorginho back into the side? Who's going to be the player that misses out? Because Kovacic has had a good season. Mason Mount has actually, after a little bit of a dip in the, you know, around sort of Christmas time, he started to play the best football of his year. Ross Barkley was starting to improve. So he's got a little bit of a selection dilemma in the middle. I still got a few issues with the defence, particularly left back, because I don't think either of them are really up to it, either Alonso or Emerson. And the goalkeeper, I don't know. Like, I think it's a funny thing to say because they don't have Chelsea's history at this top of the table, but I think I trust Wolves a little bit more. Just in terms of the players there, there's a few players at Stamford Bridge you just think probably shouldn't be there anymore or probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. And the goalkeeper, I think, is top of that list. So it's going to be really interesting. I don't think it's an acid test for Lampard, though, Mike. I think it's a kind of, you could almost see a situation where if it falls apart and they drop to a sort of a fifth or a sixth, I think that's a mandate for Lampard to do a bit more reconstruction, because he inherited something imperfect with a lot of flaws, with also a transfer ban. So I think it's kind of going to reflect on who's there. I think it's more true that sort of some of these players are playing for their long-term Chelsea careers. I think he gets a free pass, whatever happens.
As he should, and he deserves one. And I suppose all this ties into, you know, the series that we started last time about which players could emerge as the most valuable players at their club, you know, in the restarts. Now, you know, I'll try to go sometimes, you know, for less obvious choices to maybe just to stimulate our debate. But where Chelsea are concerned, I look at Olivier Giroud, you know, new contract, point to prove. He's someone who I think could become an absolutely pivotal figure in what remains of the season. Now, you've known him well at for his Arsenal days, Adrian. What do you feel about that? And in terms of not just his ability as an experience, but his character as well.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to meet him a few times. And he's a good guy, very personable, takes his football seriously. And look, he's fiercely ambitious even at this stage of his career. He looked throughout his career, just people have always written him off and said that he's not quite good enough. Yet he's won so much and he's contributed to so many great moments as well down the years. I really like Olivier Giroud as a player. And I think actually it was a slight failing on Lampard's part not to incorporate Giroud a little bit more often, just to give Tammy Abraham the odd breather here and there to apply some subtle competition. He showed great faith in Tammy. But I think he missed a trick by leaving him on the bench as often as he did Olivier Giroud. If you can say he missed a trick when they're fourth, which I think is the best they could have really hoped for this season post Hazard. So, I think he's great. He's a wonderful link man. And when you consider the players around the striker, your Willians, your Hudson-Odoi, your Mason Mounts, etc., he's a great foil, someone to bounce balls off. And he scores big goals. He's always scored big goals. And he's also scored a ton of goals from the bench. And I think it's these kind of guys are going to be so valuable on the resumption. My pick, by the way, it would be someone that hasn't got a mention yet, and that's Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Back fit. He's back fit. He's in full training. And you look at what he did last season before he got injured on that post-season tour. He was second only to Eden Hazard in terms of completed dribbles. You know, he can beat a man with a surge, with a piece of powerful play, with some quick feet. He can play in a number of positions. I just think he's going to be an absolute prize asset to Lampard in the coming weeks. He also can score off the bench. He changed it. I looked at the stats, actually, of what he did off the bench last year. And the time he was on the pitch, Chelsea scored 15 goals and conceded 3. And they averaged a goal every half hour. Now, over the course of the whole season, Chelsea averaged a goal every 52 minutes. So he is a guy that is an impact player. And I think he'll come off the bench. I don't think he'll start straight away. But he can offer competition up top He can play in behind. He can play in that three. And if Conte isn't available, then he would add a really powerful strand there. So, yeah, I think look out for Loftus-Cheek, providing, of course, he's fit enough to be involved. And from what I've read, he's in full training.
Yeah, we'll go on to Crystal Palace if we could. Now, you know, with Palace, with the greatest respect, we usually refer to them as sort of Wilf Sahar and 10 other randoms, don't we, really? You know, hugely well organised, and will probably, although they've got a pretty rough fixture list, they'll probably have enough to stay up again. And I think, you know, you can't give Roy Hodgson enough praise because of that. I just want to highlight a player who's one of my favourite players, actually, and Andros Townsend. You know, the resilience that he showed, the energy that he's got, the experience he's accumulated in a side which is striving to, you know, be equal to the sum of its parts. He's the sort of player that they need to actually kick on in many ways over the next couple of weeks. He's had his injury issues, obviously, this season. So from your point of view, is he the sort of player that a club like Palace depend upon?
I'm not sure I'd go that far. I think it's, I think I'd put it, he's the kind of player that a club like Palace benefit from having. Good footballer, good person, Andros Townsend, really likable guy. I think he's been badly done over the course of his career because, you know, people had their fun with him about the way he would shoot and cut in. And, you know, at Spurs especially, that was what he was instructed to do when he first came into the side. And that's what André Villas-Boas wanted him to be doing. He was one of the players that sort of had to fit into the Gareth Bale-shaped hole, which, you know, it's not a particularly enviable position to be in for anybody. But I feel like for the rest of his career, that's kind of given the impression of an inferior footballer, which is completely unfair. He's a very, very talented player. Can I just give a little shout out to Jordan Ayew, actually, in that Palace side? It's a little bit of a mea culpa on my part because back in pre-season, I think I actually used Jordan Ayew as a kind of cipher with which to whip Palace's recruitment.
You wouldn't have been the only one.
I don't think I was the only one, but I might as well own it now. But he's been absolutely excellent. He's a funny footballer because he does a lot of good things, but not often in a continuous sequence. So he can finish really well. He's technically a good player. He's Palace's top scorer. I think he's got 8 goals this season, which is not, you know, a huge amount. Alan Shearer's goal scoring record is probably safe from Jordan Ayew. But it's one of those success stories, and I think it reflects really well on Roy Hodgson. He's used a player who's not really a centre forward to score a lot of really important goals in a lot of really important situations. The thing about those 8 goals is that if you attach them to points that they've earned and the games that they've won, you can make a little bit of a tenuous case, but Ayew is one of the most valuable players in the league at the moment. He's in that sort of clutch of players beneath Wilfried Zaha, and I'd include Andros Townsend in this, who have really benefited from Hodgson being there. I mean, Hodgson's reputation will never really recover from England and Iceland, unfortunately. That's really unfair, but he's done a splendid job. And I maintain, the reason I bring up Ayew and the recruitment is because I still think the recruitment is pretty poor. And I think Hodgson has done a really good job of managing his way around that and of adapting players who into sort of into positions in which they're, you know, the most valuable. And it's a success story, Palace, which is quite unlikely. But yeah, these guys are very important to it, obviously.
Very, very, very quickly before we move on the recruitment, the one that they did get right was the keeper.
Yes.
I mean,
he is brilliant.
He's a match winner. And if you look at... I don't love Optus times G ratio particularly. I just think it's a little bit flawed, but he's top dog in it. And according to them, he has stopped almost 10 goals that they should have conceded. He's the keeper with the highest times G ranking. Great.
XG, and when, XG. You sound like a Luddite.
XG.
I can see him trying to smash his laptop from here. Just hates machines, hates technology.
I've always called it times G anyway. Look, it's a good job I normally have to write it down rather than speak it, then, isn't it? it's my maths A-level coming back in, you see. You know, little X is a times. So, yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Did you pass, by the way?
Of course I did.
Oh, good boy.
I did it as a footballer, interestingly. So yeah, it was one that Arsenal allowed me to sort of do A levels in my spare time. And I went back to my old school and did it in the sixth form. So yeah, it was I scraped by in the end. I have to say, I started well, faded, and clung on. I clung on desperately for a C, I think it was.
Top man. So let's talk about another goalkeeper then, if you could, at Everton, Jordan Pickford. Now, he's the sort of player who needs probably an immediate lift in both form and confidence. Under pressure at England level, you know, seems to retain the faith of Gareth Southgate, but obviously, you know, Nick Pope at Burnley and Dean Henderson at Sheffield United are really giving him a run for his money. You know, I've got a great respect for the knowledge of, you know, Dave Priest, who's late of this parish, now still in Sweden. You know, he is a goalkeeping expert and he still is basically in Jordan Pickford's corner. What do you think about him, Seb, in terms of an overall package, not just a technical goalkeeper, but almost like, are there slight sort of rough edges to his personality which can count against him as well?
I've never encountered any of those rough edges. I mean, I've mixed signed him a few times and he's a really likeable guy, really forthright. He's very much of the new generation where he answers questions as they're put to him and he's intelligent and smart. I don't know. I'm happy. I have my doubts. I don't really want to contradict Preecey, not with that facial hair that he's growing at the moment. anyone who hasn't seen that, have a look through his Instagram at the moment. That's he's fallen off the rails since he left this podcast. But I don't know. I mean, I've spoken about my fondness for Dean Henderson before. I think he's had a brilliant season. I think had Euro 2020 taken place this summer, Pickford's reputation would have saved him and Gareth Southgate's faith would have been decisive. With another year, another season, I think the kind of the base level of Pickford's performances has to pick up. There are too many mistakes. There are too many moments where, you know, they're not howlers. They're not like the Origi goal he conceded at Anfield last season. There are too many goals he concedes where you think, that doesn't look quite right. Or there's, you know, I know people have fun with his kind of slightly short arms, but there's a kind of, there's almost like a soft wristness about him, which has crept into his game, which I never used to associate with him when he came through. And I think it's form. I don't think we should suddenly start saying, you know, Jordan Pickford's a bad goalkeeper because he's not. He's an exceptional goalkeeper. He's just one that maybe has suffered because of the sort of, you know, the situation at Everton prior to Carlo Ancelotti. Let's not overlook that. They've got some big defensive issues with a bit of flux and he's got some centre-backs ahead of him who haven't had the greatest seasons. So it's a question of form, but it does need to improve.
Yeah. What's your take, Aid, on Everton as a whole? You know, Seb mentioned Carlo Ancelotti there. You know, you only have to look at his track record to understand that, you know, he will bring them round. What will you be looking for from them over the next few weeks?
Well, they need to pick up their form. They sort of dipped off a little bit. I rate Ancelotti. I think they've absolutely got the right manager. They were just up front, fantastic. Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin are a really promising partnership. Two young players, hungry, that work well together. And they are particularly well suited to playing with attacking fullbacks, and we've seen already with Luka Dina and Jibril Sidibe on the other side. That those four players, fantastic. You could substitute Seamus Coleman in there for Sidibe if you wanted. It's in central midfield where they are lacking big time. I think they've got problems. Gbamin, who they bought to be the sort of enforcer, has broken down again, I believe, in training. He's not going to be available. I just think there's a void in the middle of the park where they're a little bit weak. And yeah, just not sold on them off the ball. But look, Everton are a solid team, but those people that sort of put them in the top four category or potential top four category, I think they're eating their words. They're quite some way off of that at the moment. But look, over 18 months, maybe Ancelotti can get them there.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned top four category. You know, I think we all agreed that Leicester will stay there. I'll be interested to see how Jamie Vardy gets on in the rest of the season. I think it's been really noticeable how the decision to move away from international football has helped him as an older player. He's learning to make the most of his talent in terms of actually eking it out a bit more. I think when you look at him, I think he'll score more goals when we do get back.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, Mike. I think one of the things that Vardy's really benefited from is, I think he's someone that needs to be loved. The difference between Rodgers' management and Claude Puel, who came before him, is kind of one of them is their treatment of Vardy. He wants to be treated as the main man, and he is being, and he wants to be guaranteed of his place, and that's happening too. And the international thing, I don't know. I think you need a player's opinion on that. I mean, I don't know what sort of physical difference that creates, and you know how much easier that makes life. It's a question for a Paul Scholes, isn't it? Really, I mean, you know, how much more career can you get out of an early international retirement? I'm not sure. Player I'd like to put in there also is Harvey Barnes. I think he's been great. I covered Leicester's game at Man City, and they ended up losing, and it was ultimately a disappointing day. But if you go back to Jamie Vardy's goal that opened the game, there's a wonderful carved Harvey Barnes pass right at the heart of it, like outside of the right foot, down the line. He's a wonderful footballer. And I don't think he gets the attention of someone like a James Maddison, good player that Maddison is. But I think Barnes is another one who should be playing for England sooner rather than later.
Yeah, no, I agree on Barnes. And I think their combination is huge for Leicester. For me, Vardy is the most legendary player ever to play for Leicester City. He's got to be if they're going to have a statue of any player outside King Power, it'll be Vardy. I mean, this guy has been an absolute hero since joining from Fleetwood, you know, all those years ago. Quite remarkable. And I did a piece on strikers recently and looked into how they scored their goals. And remarkable, really. He and Danny Ings are basically the most two-footed finishers in the top flight in terms of the way they spread their goals between left and right. He's just deadly with both.
Yep. Okay, last one on this batch is Liverpool. Joe Gomez, for me, will be the one I'm looking out for. He seems to me to make that back four complete alongside Van Dijk. Again, he's had his injury issues, come through them. Also, you know, we've talked about younger players, you know, being socially aware and, you know, very confident socially. He is one, but also he's, you know, last time I spoke to him, his gratitude was very obvious for the people who helped him out when he was a young lad. You know, the sort of coaches who never really get a mention, who, you know, ferry him to trials or buy him pairs of boots because his mum and dad couldn't afford it, that type of stuff. I think he's a good character and therefore a good character for someone like Jurgen Klopp, but also as a defender, he's got an awful lot going for him,
yeah,
hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he's great. He's got his head screwed on, humble, and yeah, he's just got the traits you want to see from a modern defender. Very athletic, powerful, reads the game well, good on the ball. Yeah, look, he's tailor-made for international football. I think he'll win a stack of England caps over the next decade or so. Great pickup, absolutely brilliant pickup by Liverpool. And the other reason I think it works so well is because of Trent Alexander-Arnold, and we know where his strengths lie. They're in the opposition half. He can defend, but he's not the best defensive right back. But what Gomez does is slide across and provide elements of cover on that right-hand side in conjunction with Jordan Henderson, actually. Those two kind of sit there and shore up any gaps that Trent might leave. It just works. And he's a key man. But look, Liverpool are home and hose. They're going to win the league in two or three games, aren't they? So, yeah, I don't think they're going to need too many star men between now and the end of the season to pick up silverware. I'm interested in Salah. I love watching Salah. And I do. I just get the feeling, though, that if anyone might go, might be Salah. I think he's going to be on the radar of some really, really big clubs around the world. So, yeah, just his mindset. Keep your eye on it. If it's right and his head is in Liverpool, which I hope it will be, then yeah, onwards and upwards.
But it's the old maxim, isn't it, really? Recruit from a position of strength, and Liverpool will probably do that, won't they, Seb?
You'd have thought so. I mean, I think I agree with you. No, I mean, if there is one to go, maybe it's Salah. And if that does happen, then they could do a lot worse than bring in Timo Werner from RB Leipzig. I agree. I just think one of the best things that they did last summer, or the summer before, sorry, Liverpool didn't add for the sake of adding. You know, there was no, you know, they recognised that, you know, having signed Naby Keita the year before, having signed Fabinho, that there was a merit in just allowing that squad to mature a little bit and not add to it before it had reached its full potential. This summer, a little bit different, because I think, you know, the position of strength is, you know, the overall quality in the group, but it's also, what else is there left to achieve? There'll be European champions They didn't retain it, but, you know, they've compensated themselves by, you know, almost certainly winning the Premier League. So you have to refresh from a point of view of quality, but you also, for the sake of appetite. Jürgen Klopp's football is very exacting. It demands a very high physical price from players. You've got to have that full buy-in. So to do that, to maintain that mixture, I think that you have to introduce from the outside. You have to give a player like a Werner the opportunity to replicate the success that someone like Salah has helped provide. So it's really important. It's really interesting from a chemistry standpoint. It's not just what do we need in what position. It's what characters do you need not to interfere with what's been there and what's worked before. I know it's a little bit of a strange reality because of the pandemic, but it makes it a very interesting window for Liverpool.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting anyway, isn't it? Because, you know, we are in uncharted territory financially. It's obvious that the market will contract to a degree. Adrian, I just want to get your thoughts on David Luiz. You know, there are some conflicting reports, but it seemed for a time that they were unlikely to re-sign him. And there was a very good piece by Amy Lawrence where she totted up the cost of this one-year deal of £24 million, you know, with all the add-ons and all the intermediary fees. One, that's an absolutely mad deal. But two, do you think a player like Luiz is worth that sort of money on a one-off basis? Do you expect him to leave the club?
Well, I don't know. Just shortly before we came on air, you know, so I read some quotes from Keir Jarabchin, the agent, who said that he's optimistic that they'll come to an agreement to stay, and it might be on reduced terms. So he'll take a wage cut by the sounds of it to stay. Oh, look, I just don't want Arsenal to be that club. I mean, they were never like that when I was there. You know, Arsenal have always been pretty tight, you know, in terms of the way they do business. And I've always loved their old school nature in terms of, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to buckle. You're not going to pay. Obviously, they've paid agent fees down the years, but they've not been one of the worst culprits. But it does seem that the current leadership group are more willing to indulge in those kind of deals. And that, you know, personally, I don't want that to be the norm because it's flushing good money down the drain, in my opinion. He's replaceable. Everybody's replaceable. He's a good player. I think his character is decent in the dressing room. He's a winner. And I think he is worth keeping in many, many respects. But if it's going to cost a fortune, walk away. And replenish the squad with the younger model. That's how I'd be looking at it.
Yeah, I think we're going to be seeing a couple of sort of attractive free agents. I think Willian is probably one. I just want specifically, Seb, to ask you about Mario Götze. You know, he's been overshadowed by Brandt at Borussia. Is he the sort of reclamation project, you know, World Cup winner? He's still only 27. That a good manager, a good man manager perhaps, can get the best out of?
Personally, I don't think so. I think Mario Götze has been through a bit too much in his career. He's achieved some wonderful things. He scored the winner in a World Cup final, of course, so you can't knock a career that includes that. I think he made a few poor decisions career-wise in terms of when he left Dortmund, when he joined Bayern Munich. He also had his illness, which, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but obviously from what I've read, it seems like it was, you know, just a terrible thing to go through. And there's been some sort of mental health issues that came with that, I think, and some confidence problems. I know he's in his late 20s. I think he's a very old late 20s, if that makes sense. He's been around. I mean, we knew about Götze and he was being talked about as a £50 million player when he was 18 years old. I think there's some value to be gained from him. I don't think there's an upswing, if that's your question, Mike. I don't think there's a solution out there where it could propel him to being one of the top players in Europe again. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I just think he belongs at a kind of, at best, a sort of Tottenham level, maybe. Tottenham, Arsenal, maybe that kind of club. He's not going to contribute at a kind of Liverpool, Manchester City level. He's not going to play at, you know, he's not going to a Real Madrid or a Barcelona. He's going to a sort of a high, the gap between the Europa League and the Champions League. That's where he'll belong, I think.
Yeah. The sad truth is we all peak at different times. And like, I think he had his peak at a very young age. You know, my peak was probably about 14. it's downhill from there. But like we all, for whatever reasons, whether it's physical, mental, luck, circumstance, whatever it is, we just peak at different times. And it does feel like, yeah, he's gonna meander along, but at a lower plane than maybe we expected him to.
Yeah, I just want to basically bring everything together now with our thoughts for the day. Aid, I hope you don't mind, but can I choose one for you?
Of course, yeah.
The EFL, you know, we mentioned it right at the top of the show about, you know, clubs being unhappy that they're being told with apparently 40 minutes notice that they are going to restart on the 20th of June. You know the EFL well. Are you impressed by that?
Not really. No. I've been impressed by a lot of what Rick Parry's done, but also sort of deeply unimpressed by the EFL in general over this. No, look, communication's massive. And yeah, that seems incredibly harsh. But the bottom line is, I think everyone wants to get back. So what's there to argue about? I just think move on. I think the EFL, what they their biggest failing here is in League One and League Two, where the clubs need authority. They need someone to stand up and almost say, this is how we want it to be. And they haven't done that. And I, do you know what? If League One and League Two are knocked on the head, my worry is, and I think this will happen, is that it will lose respect. Leagues One and League Two, with the wider public at large and the SPFL in Scotland, Scottish Premier League, they lose respect for the way they've handled this. It's as if they feel it's not important enough. They've not worked hard enough, in my opinion, to try and get back to playing. Why haven't the EFL? Sorry, you've got me on my soapbox now. Why haven't the EFL asked the Premier League and asked the Premier League clubs? We need a bailout. We think it will be detrimental to the entire English football pyramid. If A, we lose clubs, they go to the wall, and B, if we don't try harder to carry on, can you give us some money to a solidarity package to get us to the end of this season and to get, you know, even if it's just to get the players tested? Haven't done it. It just makes me upset and angry, and I just feel the fallout will rumble on, because there'll be legal suits. Clubs will be so bitter about being relegated and denied the chance of promotion. What was going on now is going to scar the EFL for a long, long time, sadly.
I mean, I'm going to leave EFL to you guys, but I just wanted to applaud Jadon Sancho, actually, and at the same time condemn the people that sort of seem to take such joy in telling footballers to stick to football. It's important to remember, these are not athletes who have to belong in a box. These are young men with agency. And I think we should be applauding those that are worldly enough to speak out on weighty issues which matter to them. I think that's a really important currency. It's actually something that's been deficient in European football for a really long time. I mean, if you compare the levels of activism and social awareness that exist in American sport, for instance, versus what we've had for a long time in this country, people like Jadon Sancho are a breath of fresh air, honestly, because if you kind of... You know, the willingness to stand up for yourself, the willingness not to just become all coy when the subject deviates from professional football, I think it should be welcomed. You want people speaking out. You want people that are willing to represent their own causes and to, you know, to oppose injustice in the world. You know, all power to them. You know, I think it's the mark of a very mature young man, actually. So well done to him, and well done to him for using a personal moment, you know, moment of a first goal after an injury comeback. He's got the world at his feet, but he's still aware enough to look beyond his own environment. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'm going to end with women's football. Now, I think it's time to be blunt. I think the FA have actually betrayed the women's game. The clubs have conspired in that by allowing the season to be cancelled, and I've got a problem with that on many levels. Cancelling the season is unfair, especially as players and clubs have invested so much of themselves in an abandoned season. It also misses a huge trick. Just imagine for a moment the impact of the Women's Super League coming back in tandem with the Premier League. What's happened now is that the clubs have said, well, look, we can't afford to do so. They've been denied wider financial support, some form of solidarity fund. And, you know, women's clubs are already paupers. If you look at the FA Cup prize money, they only receive around about 1% of the men's prize money, and that's wrong. Now, UEFA are at least considering August and September tournaments to actually complete the Champions League. In this country, nothing. Now, that's poor leadership and a result of defeatist thinking. It risks the progress that's been made in recent season. Not good enough. So, thanks to you all for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast. And please, stay safe out there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.